go. Deck 78.
Hey, this is Mark A. Altman, and we're back on Deck 78, but this week we're going at warp speed to a galaxy far, far away because we're talking Star Wars, and more specifically, the Star Wars Holiday Special with Kyle Newman.
I believe the term is we're going light speed, not warp drive.
Okay, fair, fine. We're making the jump to hyperspace.
Well, we know the trip, it shifts from warp into light speed.
Right.
Well, don't you know if you're going to travel?
Light speed is significantly slower than warp speed.
If you're going to travel between galaxies, you got to go through that big oval thing. I don't know.
So welcome,
anyway,
Kyle Newman.
We're delighted to have filmmaker and producer and writer, and he's done it all. He's also, when you talk about, you know, famous Star Wars fans, legendary Star Wars fans, obviously, Kyle is high on the list. He contributed to the Clone Wars, and he is also the director of Fanboys, which brings two tastes that taste great together, Star Wars and Star Trek, into one tantalizing mix. But we're so happy to have him here to talk about his great new documentary, which is available now on Blu-ray, on digital. It recently had a select theatrical engagement. It's A Disturbance in the Force, talking about one of the great legendary pieces of Star Wars ephemera, the Star Wars Holiday Special. Of course, as always, I'm here with Darren Doctorman and Stephen Melching, and we're talking about one of our favorite subjects. So I gotta ask you, because I you know, first of all, you know, it has been an underdocumented part of Star Wars lore, obviously disowned by Lucas and Lucasfilm for so long, and yet it's like the lost ark. You know, everybody who discovers it is, they always think, I'm going to be the one who appreciates it. You know, I'm going to see this and I'm going to love it. And they don't know what they're talking about. Everyone says it's terrible, but I bet it's not as terrible. And then they see it and they say, oh yeah, that really is as terrible as I heard it was. How did you first see the Star Wars Holiday Special? And do you recall what your reaction was?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. That's great. I appreciate coming on to chat with you guys, because I know you guys know this stuff and you live and breathe this stuff. Second of all, like the Ark of the Covenant, their faces get melted when you experience it. You're not supposed to look directly at it. You're supposed to close your eyes like Indian Marion and hope you survive it. How did I discover it? You know, I was perfectly timed to be a child of Star Wars. I think I experienced it. I was like one and a half with my siblings. I was born in 76 and it was late in early fall or summer of 77, where I think I went with a group of cousins and stuff and we saw Star Wars. And I don't remember the movie. I just remember like all this energy. Everyone was like obsessed with this thing. And from then on, I just learned Star Wars words. Before English words, I could pronounce the characters on the back of a 12 back or 20 back card before I could say normal human sibling names. And it was a problem. And I remember, though, being aware of the holiday special and then being told the night it was on, we were going to my uncle's or something. And I cried and I thought I was missing something. And we caught some of it at my uncle's, and then we drove home and I was tired and I turned it back on at home and I think I fell asleep. I didn't see it all. So I got glimpses of this weird thing. I didn't sit and watch it. And then I forgot it for a long time until I saw, you know, I started to get back into like the history of Star Wars stuff when it was dead. You know, there's that period in the 90s where it was just dead. You'd go to like a B. Dalton and there'd be a book dusty in the back with action figures. You're like, wait, there was a Power of the Force line that I didn't know all these figures.
Wait, the heyday of Shadows of the Empire was dead?
Yeah, so it was prior to that. And it was that era in the when George Lucas had written in the Star Wars fan club magazine that like, or the Bantha Tracks had wound down and he was like, I'm not doing Star Wars anymore. Suck it. That kind of like experience. And everyone was like, oh no. And all you had were maybe the glimmer of like Ralph McQuarrie art on a Bilou micro machine box, or you had Bendems percolating in the,
in the Bendems.
You had dark Empire comic, and you had that you know, Timothy Zahn. I remember my friend had the Timothy Zahn book, and it was like high school preschool start. And I was like, what the hell are you reading? And he had the hardcover book and he was like, oh, it just came out. And I was like, I had to go to the store afterwards. And in that era, I got back into all things Star Wars. And that's when I remembered there was this holiday special. There was a Tomarts magazine guide that had the Wookiee family action figures.
Depicted. That's right. I remember that Tomarts. Prototype Wookiees. Yeah.
It was crazy. So then I went to a New York Comic Con. I was maybe 16. And there was a Trek dealer. And he had said, he had one or two Star Wars things. Like, do you have more Star Wars stuff? And he was like, oh, God, Star Wars stuff. You know, it was like, it was like the crap he didn't want to deal with. And he pulled out this ugly old dusty box. And he had the Star Wars Holiday Special.
It's like asking for porn.
Yeah, it felt illicit. And I overpaid for it. I didn't even negotiate. I was like 16 years old in New York City first time, like without my parents, with a friend. And I got this VHS and I went home and watched it. And it was cringe worthy, tear worthy. And then I proceeded to collect all the different versions I could of people saying, I've got the best version, right? You know? And the one we end up depicting in the doc, the one we use, there's two actually. There's the Zion cut, which can be found. It's hard to find, but it is a really good capture of it. And then there is another cut we got, I think it's from the 3/4 inch master of Smith and Hemian, who are the producers who previously done the David Bowie Bing Crosby Christmas special. I think it comes from their master, right? And it's better than what Lucasfilm has. And between those two, we would vacillate and pick whichever looked better. Was this for the scene? If it was the cantina scene, looked better on one, we'd use that. And then there was cleanup and up-res and AI enhancement. So you are seeing, if you watch the doc, the best version of the holiday special you could ever see for those clips we do use.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I was amazed at the quality of the clips because, of course, other than that, I mean, it looked terrible when I first saw it in 78, obviously, on CBS with rabbit ears. But over the years, obviously, these bootlegs that you buy at conventions, which is where most of us, you know, got it, are not particularly good. So I was really stunned, you know, given that, you know, presumably, I'm sure you had no cooperation whatsoever from Lucasfilm on this particular project, that it was really remarkable how good it looked. And of course, I'm just talking about the quality of the picture.
And we do that little thing in there where we show the effect of, you know, copying and passing it along and the telephone handling and how it just gets worse and worse. And it is hard to find there's no pristine copies that exist, even from this master that existed. It was in a state of disrepair. So it was trying to find the best presentable way to get this thing on screen. And I think it does look, it does a pretty good job of saying this is probably close to what it looked like on a good TV set back then.
So it's kind of in the same boat as the original theatrical release of the first trilogy.
It's hard to find, right? And which version? Because, you know, when it first came out, there was like, you know, people always gripe about George Lucas redoing the movie. And there's since it came out in 30 prints, every time it got re-released, he tweaked or did something to it. So what is the original version that everyone has in their mind? Changing titles, changing effects, there's sound changes.
So, you know, the 70mm version, the 35mm version.
By the way, I have to say, I mean, a lot of these stories have been chronicled. Some of them have been chronicled before. Obviously, Bruce Valanche has talked about it a lot. But what I really loved about the documentary, which I never really thought about and never really saw discussed in any of the journalism about the holiday special, was the real reason why it existed and how Donnie and Marie was sort of the precursor to this happening, that Lucas needed to keep Star Wars alive in the popular imagination because there was a fear that it would go away, that it was, you know, it would burn brightly and disappear, and that he was just putting the characters in every parade, sending them to high school graduations. No, okay, maybe not that, but putting them on every variety show to keep the characters alive, to keep the movie in theaters, to keep the visibility. And that the success of this on these variety shows, which were immensely popular at the time, ultimately led to the to the holiday special, and the unique format that it had, which was doing Star Wars as a TV variety special with a cartoon intermission, which is really interesting because I've never really heard that discussed so much. And the clips from Donnie Marie were insane.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you guys on your film did a terrific job of putting the special into the context of 70s television and how hugely popular these kinds of variety shows were. It was very normal to see several of those a year.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, one of the things we didn't want to do was a Mystery Science Theater where you just riff on it or make fun of it. We wanted to give it that context. I studied film. I also minored in art history. One thing when you're looking at all these things, you have to understand the economic context, the political context. What is the form? What is the nature of art? What are their peers doing? When you talk about these artists, these movements, these trends in film, and the waves of film. And the holiday special didn't invent the variety format. It was just merely plugged into it. So we had to get into the mindset of George, which was, I'm investing all my money into a sequel. I'm building my company and a VFX company around this. I'm moving my company. I'm creating this autonomous situation for myself to succeed. It's all on me. And so then he would make these choices, like these different appearances, to keep Star Wars as relevant as possible, considering that's what people did at the time. You didn't have the internet. You didn't have as many opportunities to promote the film. So you'd plug it into Variety, and hopefully eyeballs were on it. And as what happened with Donnie Marie, it created a spike in viewership. So in that flurry is when he did greenlight this holiday special and then got busier and busier. So it was both to provide context to, I think, where George was at mentally as a businessman, not just a filmmaker, but also just American late 70s television. And you have this dying format that Star Wars is then squeezed into. And yes, it's called the worst 2 hours of television ever. But as we wanted to point out, there is worse. There are worse specials, and television has had greater lows. It's just because it had the name Star Wars on it. And it's also, in tandem with that, is Lucasfilm made this taboo. George didn't want people to talk about it. We found very late in the game that clip of George at the 10th anniversary of Star Wars in 87. He gets directly asked by somebody about what's going to happen with the Wookiee special. And he's like, I believe it's coming out on video. And I guess at that point, he was still entertaining the idea of putting it out there. J.W. Rinsler, it was his last interview, and he's a brilliant writer and historian. And, he says that nobody got fired after this, And so the fallout wasn't end of days. It just was, let's not talk about it. But look where we are now. We are at this place in Star Wars culture where you go to the theme park this year and there's thousands of people going for Life Day, buying sanctioned Wookiee snuggy red robes to celebrate Life Day. They're selling orbs. They're selling 3¾-inch Kenner vintage action figure, which is, by the way, is like one of the most beautiful things they put out. And to finally put a photo from the special, not the animated special of Boba Fett, but to acknowledge Chewbacca in a photographic and depicted on a photograph on the card back. And then talk about it. Obviously, they've done Lego holiday specials and everyone's played with the idea of the holiday special, but Lucasfilm is actually, and Disney, are embracing and monetizing this. So that seemed to be fortuitous with us as we were going down the road of making this, because it took 3 years to watch them open the floodgates and talk about it. Now, they're not releasing it anytime soon, but they are at least merchandising.
Acknowledging its existence. I was amazed that on Disney Plus that they made the cartoon available. Yeah. And of course, that's the one thing that seems to have escaped unscathed from the reputation of the documentary, that people say, yeah, the documentary is terrible, but the Boba Fett cartoon is great, right? So
relatively.
It's a relative, but that's what they say, because in relation to the actual rest of it, to the Jefferson Starship and B. Arthur and Harvey Korman, Boba Fett looks really good. So my question is for you, kind of what surprised you in your research? And as you were doing this, what did you discover maybe that you didn't know about the holiday special, or something that surprised you, you know, obviously for me, it was certainly the Donnie Marie, because I had seen that, but I was a young kid at the time. And I think it's the only time I ever saw Darth Vader not voiced by James Earl Jones, because that's been so important ever right. since that James, other than Brock Peter, not Roscoe Lee Brown in the radio show, or Brock Peters.
It was Brock Peters.
Brock yeah. Peters. Yeah. So, you know, it was really interesting to see somebody.
Yeah, but that was Thurl Ravenscroft.
Thurl Ravenscroft,
the voice
yeah.
Of Tony the Tiger.
And Paul Lynn as Tarkin, crazy yeah. stuff. Yeah. But anyway, so what surprised you the most in sort of producing this documentary? What you found out or learned that maybe you didn't know or were just surprised as you dug deep into the history of this thing?
It was just a waterfall of fascinating things. I mean, getting into the story of Charlie Lippincott and how he was such a vital part of early Star Wars history, yeah. which we wanted to capture. Like, how did they harness people to get people there day one? Even now, people are like, how do you get people there opening weekend? You know, it's the grassroots stuff that he did. That was him spearheading it, and not just like George, the brainchild of Charlie. So getting into that, you realize, oh, okay. And this then was a byproduct of the machine that Charlie had created. And he was present with those meetings with George. I didn't realize he had that influence. I think getting to the bottom of George's actual involvement was always, you know, once we showed those writers in the Star Wars Vault book, it says they wrote it, right? And that's a recent book. What was that, 2019? But it was incorrect. And we showed the writers, and they're honest. They're like, I wrote that. It's terrible. You know, they have great recollections. They're like, I don't know what this thing is. We never saw this. Neither of us touched this.
Yeah.
And then we knew it wasn't them. They were wrongly attributed. And they're like, that's George. You know, that's really coming from the mind and voice of George. And maybe he had someone else, a secretary, dictate it or something, or type it up. But those type of discoveries that took a while to get to were really worth it. And there was a cool story which wasn't in it, and it pertains to the Boba Fett thing. So George was a fan of, you know, Mobius and then these guys' style of art, and he was connected to them through David Akumba, and George flew them down from, I guess, Toronto to yep. LA. And he picked them up at the airport, I think, and he took them to this big meeting at Taco Bell. So this is like 1977 or 78. And George, Taco Bell, was that even a thing? And I mean, I didn't hear about that till much later where I grew up in New Jersey. But here he is taking them to fast food. So George is just like not taking them to the Ivy or something. He's yeah. like, it gives you insight into the great GL and the way he does stuff and his sense of humor. And he is an experimental guy at heart. You know, looking at this thing, it is very George to go down the road of a Wookiee family and say, I'm gonna inhabit this culture and take a look at it. And why not? I don't care. I'm gonna try it. Let's do it. Let's try it.
The thing is, it has a direct connection almost to what he intended on THX 1138. Because he and Walter Murch had intended to make a movie that came from another culture, right? To show us a movie that we don't understand because we aren't in that culture. But the portrayal of the Wookiee family at the beginning is entirely in that spirit, and that's why there's no subtitles. That's why we're just sort of dropped right into it. And that's actually one of the things that fascinated me the most when I first saw it, because it's actually trying something different and trying to break out of that mold of regular TV. And I think that's the most satisfying part of it for me, you know.
The variety aspects do undercut it. But the basic thing of going home with the Wookiees to their culture, to their house, create a new holiday and have that type of experience was a very George thing. He wanted it to mirror going home with the hobbits to a hovel or something. Sure. You wanted to like really step into another world and not have the entry points that traditional cinema or storytelling would have. And THX is groundbreaking. It's very ahead of its time, very misunderstood. I think that's knowing the way George thinks and handles things, American Graffiti, all of his stuff it kind of challenges preconceived notions about what's safe and what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And he was fantastic at processing the influences, things that, you know, he absorbed them and let them emerge in something new. And now when people make Star Wars, they just reference Star Wars.
Right.
George was creating a new language. It was alchemic. And he just said, I like all these things. And then out came something totally new and fresh, you know? And not that the holiday special was that, but there was a strange boldness to it. And he's a visionary. I mean, look at the VR stuff, and it's awful. But like the fact that he's depicting this stuff way ahead of its time, and he thinks this is where, you know, you're gonna be doing this in the leisure of your home, and there's gonna be these mobile headsets and all this stuff. He was very, I don't know, he is a visionary in more ways.
And yet it's for CBS at 8 o'clock. You know, mainstream broadcast network, and I, you know, and it's Quest for Fire, the first, you know, 20 minutes. And I vividly remember, and there's not much I remember from 1978, but, you know, my whole family sitting around the TV, and everyone, as Seth Green puts it, tapping out. First my mother leaves, and then my dad, and then my brother. I'm the only one who makes it through the whole thing. It's so audacious, as you allude to, like, to literally not subtitle it. And have this whole sequence where they're talking in another language, and this is a show for you know, following up on Star Wars, which, you know, certain expectations, action packed, funny, humor, swashbuckling, and the holiday special is none of that. It's crazy.
It's void of all of the, you know, the samurai. It's void of the serial.
Yeah,
you know, serialized type film. It's void of the Western. It's void of all the different influences, and yeah. It just really lives in this variety space. And I think that's where George was most shocked, that he thought he was going to like have a hodgepodge thing, but I don't think he expected it to fully inhabit that bizarre format.
It seems like once it went from being like a 1 hour special to being, you know, a 2 hour special, they filled a lot of time with musical numbers and dance numbers and the typical variety show stuff.
Yeah. Well, that one sequence I did, you know, you asked, well, I love that bit with the dancers, and they're talking about, it was a family troupe. You know, we also interviewed the two brothers. They are not in it, but they sat down and spoke, and the mother and the sister kind of represented the troupe best, but them talking about their father being, part of, you know, was it Thief of Baghdad? And that sequence where they're watching the miniature people perform, and then here we are watching Lumpy watch the miniature performance, and there's this weird circularity, and this is like 40 years later, and this was the family doing that, and now they're doing this, and it was like, did they get picked because of that pedigree of being miniatures inside of something? It's just like a whole world of decisions that it just opens a can of worms. You're like, who picked this, and how did this happen? And I mean, we could have gone on for a long time. There was a story with Grace Slick, which we'd heard. There is a book called Disturbances in the Forest by Steve Kozak, who's one of the co-directors, and he wrote, if you're really interested in the subject, check out the book. And some of the things that we didn't have time to get into, the real estate in the film, or would require too much backstory, end up in the book. And I think it's in there. It's one of them about Grace Slick. She had gotten removed from Jefferson Airplanes / Starship because of something inappropriate in Germany. Maybe she insulted them or called them all Nazis or something. There's something with a Nazi salute that was awful. And she got kicked out of the band. And then she heard that the band was doing something with Star Wars, which was the biggest thing on earth, and felt like, well, I need to be there. And apparently she was trying to break onto the lot to be in the special. And so that we couldn't get the full story from everybody. Some people never heard of that, and some people knew it clearly, but we were trying to, it just felt like too hard to shoehorn into the doc itself. But you know, George remained interested in trying to affiliate Star Wars with Christmas. You have the Christmas and the Stars album that came out, I think, in 1980. John Bon Jovi's first professional recording.
And it raised the first question ever of what do you get a Wookiee for Christmas when he already owns a comb?
So the bonkers is there. He didn't learn from this in 78 and say, we're not going out bonkers. We're not doing Christmas albums. He learned to the degree where he's like, I'm never letting anyone go make Star Wars without me outside of the books. But that's why you have this huge gap between 1983 and when the special editions heat up again, and, you know, 96, 97 promoting them.
Right.
He didn't let anybody do anything with it. And he took that hiatus because he knew the danger of letting people play in that world without his supervision. And that would never happen.
Go ahead, Kyle.
The biggest gift of the special is that George learned this lesson.
What's your perspective on the cast's involvement? Because, of course, it's like a game of telephone, you know, especially with actors. They tell the stories over the years, and it changes and changes until it's print the legend by the end. But, you know, what's your perspective on their involvement? Obviously, the stories of everyone being, you know, a crazy high during the filming of this, and, you know, how much arm twisting there was, and what their perspective was at the time. Obviously, you have a lot of footage of the cast from various public appearances talking about their perspective, and it's become a punchline. But at some point, you know, you had Harrison Ford, who was doing big movies like Force 10 from Navarone, Hanover Street, and, you know, had been in Star Wars. You know, he's in it. You know, obviously Mark had, you know, Corvette Summer. I mean, he had a career, and he gets them all to do this.
I think there was a contractual obligation, and I think they probably classified it as some form of promotion. I think the fact that they were already tied in to do a sequel, if there wasn't a sequel, it was a one-off, they probably would have not come back for a holiday special. But the fact that they're doing this big movie, the sequel to the biggest movie of all time, my opinion is, in hindsight, they've all changed their tune on it. I think at the time they were all like, oh my God, Christmas special, we're king of the world, we're the Beatles, let's go. Like they all happily went to set to film the Star Wars Christmas special to promote it. And they all have gotten used to the rhetoric of, wow, this is bad, let's all pretend we didn't want to do this. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure, but that's my assessment. Like at the time, maybe while they were there making it, they were like, what are we doing here? But when it got floated and George called them, it was all, I'm sure it wasn't like, no way, I'm not coming to do this, but I'll see you for Empire. You know, right. I don't think that was the tone with the cast. I think they were up and were like, great. And they trusted him.
Well, and with the movie cast, they probably only, you know, how long did they shoot? A couple of days,
max.
Maybe?
Yeah. I think 2 days max each, if that. And, you know, they did, there was a story about how Carrie really wanted to sing. And I bet she just pitched. She's like that. She's bold. She pitched herself. She's like, well, I'm doing this, I want to sing. And he's probably like, okay. You know, it was that. I was like, I'm not doing it unless you make me, let me sing type of deal making. I think she was new and excited, and Star Wars was a phenomenon, and they were rock stars. And they probably relished it. Look at Mark on Bob Hope doing tap dancing and Mark going on the Muppet Show. I don't think that you had to twist their arm to promote Star Wars.
And Mark, of course, beginning of a very successful voiceover career.
Yep.
Mm. You know, when you think what which has been very successful for him.
Huge.
Before seeing your doc, I didn't realize the major connection between the holiday special and the Carol Burnett show. Other than Harvey Korman, obviously. But, you know, the behind the scenes writers who, you know, took care of the musical section of the show, because, and obviously the connection with CBS, because they produced the Carol Burnett show. And I hadn't realized what a sort of close fit that was at the time.
Yeah, you're right. It's very enlightening to when you. Look, I'd heard all these stories, and you can go on YouTube and watch all these different clips and different thoughts about things, and you can watch the different ways Star Wars were promoted back then. But what we wanted to do was aggregate and curate and really take you through the logic of all this to understand how something so illogical existed. And it made sense. They're like, okay, these people are having success doing this, and we're targeting this type of talent, and we can pull them in. And it happened quickly, so they were trying to pull in safe things. And in this aggregation of safe, they made something, you know, entirely flat and unappealing. Having the insurance of Smith and Hemian, you know, who had done something really successful and they weren't really involved. But then you hear Ken and Mitzi Welsh, you know, you hear that audio of her saying, I saw all these audio tapes and I cried.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And then you have, and Mickey Herman, who's the Lucasfilm liaison and really the voice of George in this madness. And I think she was in over her head too. You know, it wasn't never to throw anybody under the bus. It was always say, let's look at this thing in a very objective way. We're not going in. No one needs to go into this saying this is the worst thing ever. It's already been the butt of a million jokes for 40 plus years. It was really, let's go explore how it happened. And that's the subtitle. I didn't love the subtitle, but the subtitle really does speak to what the movie is. How did this thing happen? And then line them up. And like you said, you have these preeminent, you know, television writers, and you pull that in and you're like, okay, this can be a foundation for what this is, to make this investment wise.
And you mentioned earlier about, you know, the context of this coming out in 1978, that period between Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, a 3-year period. And I think to this, prior to that point, you know, when you had a series of films like the Planet of the Apes films, those came out, what, 1 year apart? Mm-hmm. And you had the Bond
was 1 or 2 years apart. It was never 3 until later.
Yeah, a 3-year period between films was an eternity, especially in the period before, you know, the very dawn of home video. Most people didn't have VCRs at home. You know, you didn't have, obviously, the internet or anything like that. So, you know, I know we can all talk about how during that period as children, if there was ever a whiff of seeing anything Star Wars on TV, you tuned in like, oh my God, Mark Hamill's going to be on Merv Griffin. Maybe they'll show a clip and I can see a few fleeting seconds of Star Wars on television, or, you know, the opening to That's Hollywood, where there's a shot of Darth Vader's TIE fighter. Like, oh my God, I saw the TIE fighter. Yeah. I mean, there was just such a hunger to see this, and from George's perspective, wanting to feed that hunger and keep the movie alive, the series alive, until his next film could come out.
And I always look at George as maybe the boldest, very, very bold and most successful independent filmmaker. Empire Strikes Back, the money he puts back into the business, the money he puts back into the technology and the art is unprecedented. How he's moved the business along creatively. He's making Phantom Menace and he's shooting reshoots using a different camera. He's using digital to test for Attack of the Clones. He's always thinking ahead. And you have, you know, Empire Strikes Back is maybe the biggest risk he took in his life, because
it's all like, on the line.
Can I recapture this and do it with my own company? I've started this special effects company now. Didn't work well the first time, and it worked, but we barely scraped by. Now I have to make this work. And it's my money. And he's bold in that way. I look at Return of the Jedi, and you have the greatest movie villain of all time up until then. And what does he do? He just could have made it simple and you got to defeat him and finally kill him. No, he's I'm going to humanize him. I'm going to demask him. I'm going to make you cry when he has an emotional moment with his son. And on top of that, I'm going to also create an even scarier villain, more nefarious than the one you thought was the villain. And he didn't have to. That's an independent movie that cost $35 million. That's like insane. And everyone's like, oh, it's terrible because there's Ewoks. You're like, yeah, but the swings that he took in leveling up the visual effects, the production, and even narratively, mythologically, are pretty unprecedented, and it gets marginalized. And so he felt, I think, very confident after the risks he took in this little window, the success with Empire, to then double that budget and go even bigger and wrap it all up. And so it's a weird footnote, the special, but it is, I think, an important one in the psyche of him as a creator, you know? And I think the opening line of the doc is, you know, the story, there's always more interesting stories about failure than success. Yeah. And I think a failure like this had far greater ramifications on George than maybe just the success of Star Wars, because I love the quote where he's like, I never got to see Star Wars. He's like, I'm the only person who never got to see Star Wars, you know, because I made it. I never got to experience it. And yet he didn't really make the holiday special. And he's probably the one with the most at stake in the making of this thing. And then he goes and he sees this and he can't undo it. That's gotta be a horrifying feeling, to be like, I struck lightning in a bottle. And now, what the hell is going on? Like, this could be everything. So it just, you could feel that weighed on him.
But thankfully also, you know, like we were talking about before, at that period in time, it was easy to make things just disappear down the memory hole because people didn't have VCRs that you're recording and it didn't show up on YouTube the next day. It's right. It could just be forgotten.
It didn't really have toys. There was like one book. There was a Jefferson Starship single. A couple of Starlog magazines would have pictures from it or confuse them. You had the blue
snap. It was on the cover of one.
Yeah.
Confusion. There's things like that that let it not die. And here we are, look, 45 years later, there's a doc about it. We're talking about it. And I think it's partially because they didn't want people to talk about it. And it became this weird taboo thing, this weird Easter egg in fandom. And with fandom, you're always trying to find the more niche or secret or underground thing to prove you're more than someone else. I think that was a thing for a while. Now everything's available instantly and you're like, oh, I want to find out about this. And it's like, everything's there. I think the kids don't know that this was an era where you as a fan, like you were talking about, you know, Steven, you were desperate for anything. The action figures were a year late. It's crazy. Yep. And you had to play the actual Star Wars play at home was what kept it alive. We created these stories in our imagination of what the sequels could be, what the prequels could be, which invariably leads to this letdown because they were never going to be the equivalent of our headcanon. We always
like so much of Star Wars, the only failure here is not meeting expectations. And I think that, you know, in terms of its actual success, CBS had a huge ratings for it that night. So they fulfilled their deal, and you know, plus it was the first time that Kenner put out an actual commercial showing their whole line of toys. That was a huge moment, and you know I still have my cassette that I made that night, and I listened to it over and over again over the years, and it's truly a moment in history for us as fans, because it happened at that nexus point, you know, before it turned into something for everybody, you know. Yeah. And it's really a fascinating time to remember.
Well, you can't underestimate the significance also of the Boba Fett cartoon, because you put it in context and you think, okay, he has a character that wasn't in the movie that he's teeing up for the next movie that's coming out in 2 years. That he's introducing here. So he, you know, and a toy, you know, of a character that hasn't even been in the movie yet. I mean, that is part of the marketing genius of George Lucas. And, you know, he certainly didn't do any damage to that character because people were, regardless of what you think of the special or even the Nelvana cartoon, people were fascinated by that character from the moment they saw him in that.
That's true. And you were like, you're right. There's 13 million people that watched that night.
Yeah.
I think it was 13 million people and they sold their advertising. The reason it became a 2-hour special is because there was this unprecedented interest in advertising for this thing. And they were like raking in the money. So from CBS's perspective, you're right. They achieved their goal. And I think no matter what, for George, it did, whether he wants to admit it or not, it did achieve the necessary goal, because like you said, it put the mainline action figures and the prospect of play at home, these commercials, and it kept it alive at a Christmas time when it would have dipped. Who knows if there wasn't that connective baton of the special in the middle here, how Star Wars would have been received, or if they didn't take those steps to keep it on late night television and put it on Richard Pryor and put it on Bob Hope, would that have allowed it to diminish, you know, compared to the other franchises that were hitting every year or two? So I don't know, but I think it's despite how being bad it is, it did serve its purpose.
Yeah. And then you thought, oh, well, I'll play with the toys and I'll come up with a better story than they did for the holiday special. So it fanned the imagination.
But I absolutely can't tell you the excitement when my mail away Boba Fett action figure arrived. That this new character, like, oh my God, it's Boba Fett. What is he? This, you know, Mandalorian super commando. What's that? Or Imperial super commando.
That was awesome. The best. Getting those things in the mail. There was Bosk. There was Forlom. Now 4LOM. There was Admiral Akbar, the Emperor, Anakin. It was like even that those weird modular playset things that came with, you know, the backdrops, the white those white shapes, those were like,
oh, the little stands. Yeah,
yeah, those that were stand. Huge moments. Yeah, you get the axe, forgot you'd smell that plastic, and you like,
yes. Oh, or one of my favorites, the little packet of gear that was like different rifles and the back, the little backpacks and the masks.
If that had would have come with a Minok, kind of like the trash compactor, that probably would be the most iconic mail away of all time. If that had come, it would have been the most coveted
mail away. That's so funny. Well, Kyle, we're so glad to have had you talk about the new film, A Disturbance in the Forest. You can check it out on streaming. You can buy it on Blu-ray. Steve's holding up a copy right now. It's absolutely worth your time if you're a Star Wars fan or you're just a fan of kitsch or you know, television of the era. I mean, I love the fact they open it with tonight, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will be preempted to bring you a CBS special presentation. I mean, these are people that get it. So many of these things are cash-ins or, oh, well, it's Star Wars. This is a passionate love affair with Star Wars turned into a wonderful movie, and you're going to love it, and you should definitely go and check it out. But Kyle, always good to talk to you. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you for the kind words. I mean, that's the thing. It's passion. We didn't want to make a hit piece. We wanted to explore it and catalog a piece of Star Wars history that rarely is talked about, especially now. It's aimed to be forgotten, and get these guys on camera before, you know, maybe they pass away. And we have lost a few people since we made this: Gilbert Gottfried, J.W. Yep. Winsler.
He has the best quote too. He said, "I can't believe there's something this bad on television that I wasn't in."
there is a 10 minute of him telling the story of Star Wars, very X-rated. Didn't make it in either. Yeah, so it's like you said, it was done with love and passion, and yeah, we really tried to get it right. You know, it took 3.5 years.
Well, there's also a certain purity in a way to the holiday special. It was just, it's a product of its time. You know, it's not, I never saw it as cynical in the way that, I know it seems like so many sort of geek related movies and television are so calculated these days. And this one is just this, you know, almost anarchic, you know, crazy, over the top, bewildering, sweet product of its time.
Let's see what happens. Yeah,
there was an innocence to it, and there was an innocence to that time, and I think that's lost to us now. And you're right, in the cynical corporate way that everything has to be synergized and planned, you know, 14 years in advance with which phase we're in, and here we are. He's just like, sure, go with it. But thank you guys for having me on, and for A, watching it, and B, the kind words about it. Jeremy Kuhn and Steve Kozak are the co-directors, and Jeremy's also the editor. And Adam F. Goldberg is our exec producer from The Goldbergs and Muppet Mayhem, which just won
an Emmy. Yeah, congratulations to them.
And so we're all people who really genuinely love this subject matter. So if I think even if you're not into Star Wars, there's something in it for you, and that's something else we tried to program. It's not just for the Star Wars fan. It's people that could be fans of pop culture, just a fascinating slice of American history.
Well, just fantastic. Like the holiday special, it's not for Star Wars fans.
Well, great. Well, look, Kyle, thank you for joining us, and everybody out there, thank you for joining us. We'll be back with another episode of Deck 78 in 2 weeks, and of course Inglourious Treksperts every week wherever you listen to podcasts. So until next time, on behalf of Steve Melching, Darren Doctrum, and myself, Mark A. Altman, fire the rockets.
Deck 78 is an exclusive podcast from Treksperts Plus.